issues are the exact same ones that you and I have to deal with every day. There couldn't be a more practical solution. What I'm trying to show to myself, and hopefully to you as well, is that while these are very practical matters, they're not just a string of unrelated issues. What James does in this book is to try to show that there is a certain wholeness about a godly life. You can't compartmentalize. Over here are the temptation and trials, and over here is my visiting the fatherless and the widows. Over here is the how I deal with anger. Over here is how I deal with trials in my knowledge. What James is saying is that these things are all wound up together. And what I've done in thinking about this here is to try to show you basically chapter 1 and the first part of chapter 2 and how the line of thought flows. James writes in a way where he'll show you the negative side. He'll illustrate what he's talking about by showing you the opposite of what he really wants us to do. He'll show you, sometimes we teach what we're after in a positive way and just leave it at that. James talks about the other side of it too. And then his typical approach is to get to a certain point and to use the last thought in his discussion of one topic to launch into the discussion of the next. In James chapters 1 and 2, he shows that where believers find themselves under the pressure of temptation or trial, and they don't handle that wisely and with humility and so forth, then a mistaken view of God develops. We start thinking that this is God's fault. God is doing this to me. Why is he not rescuing me from this? He caused this and made it to happen and so forth. That mistaken view of God leads to a certain kind of anger and an unreceptiveness to the communication that's the lifeblood of relationship. And anger, which causes us to be slow to listen instead of quick to listen, and an anger which causes us to be quick to speak instead of slow to speak, whether we're dealing with God or other people. And you can see that what we've started here is an unhealthy cycle. We've got the ball rolling in the wrong direction here. And this anger and anger and unreceptiveness soon leads to an indifference about the major life issues for a believer. And that's where we are here. Verse 22 beginning now, one of the most familiar little paragraphs in James, but a very important one. James 1, 22 through 25. Jan, you got your book open. Would you read for us, please?
But prove yourselves doers of the word, and not merely hearers who delude themselves. For if anyone is a hearer of the word and not a doer, he's like a man who looks at his natural face in a mirror. For once he has looked at himself and gone away, he has immediately forgotten what kind of person he was. But one who looks intently at the perfect law, the law of liberty, and abides in it, not having become a forgetful hearer, but an effectual doer, this man shall be blessed in what he does.
All right, thanks, Dan. Now, look at the goal here is how do we practice a religion, a response to the Lord that will bless us? And the two things, remember here he said were to be quick to hear, slow to speak, and slow to wrath, right? Now he says, but just hearing won't get the job done. And you notice in verse 22, you're to certainly be a hearer, but if you only hear and never do, what's the net effect of that? You deceive yourself. All right. And so let's think about this for a second. The illustration he uses is that if someone is a hearer and not a doer of the word, what's he like? Give me the illustration that he uses to show that.
Like someone who observes his face in the mirror.
All right, like someone who observes his face in a mirror, but he doesn't do anything about it. Now, obviously, we're not talking here about the things we can't do anything about. But we're talking about something which is, somebody's got a big smudge, or his hair is messed up even worse than usual, or whatever, and he looks in the mirror and stares at what he sees, and this just turns and walks away. Have you ever seen a mama with her little boy, and she's trying to fix him up and smooth his hair or to wipe whatever's on his face and something always is off of that and so forth? And in this case, it's the grown-up looking and seeing but not doing anything about it. Now, the way to, how do you cure that tendency or that deceptive danger? What's James asking us to do? Quit looking? No, don't quit looking. You hear, but what?
You got to look intently.
All right. You look intently, you look with interest, you pay attention to what you're seeing, and you look into the word, verse 23, and then what else? All right, he wants us, he says here, to hear intently, to look intently, then to do and to persevere in this doing. Those are the four things that I notice with this. He's already talked about hearing. Now he says, you look intently, look at yourself, and what we mean by that is you compare yourself with what you find in the Word, what you hear the Lord saying in His Word, and then you do it. One of the things that I remember years ago, Ira North, and I was a college student at the time. Ira North worked with a congregation in the Nashville area, and I ran across one Sunday morning what he called the Amazing Grace Bible class. Any of you ever see that? The Amazing Grace Bible class. And he had a lesson about this passage. And what he said is, Christianity is a do religion. And let's just take a minute here to look at what he says. Notice verse 22. Be doers of the word and not hearers only. Then notice verse 23, if anyone is a hearer and not a doer, and then notice verse 25 at the end of the verse, someone who is not a hearer who forgets, but a doer who asks, who acts, he'll be blessed in his doing. So note that this is obviously the point that James wants to emphasize. Eddie?
Is he making a comparison here from looking at ourselves in the mirror as an earthly thing, and then going down in the 25th verse, looking at ourselves as a spiritual thing in the Bible, and have that reflect back at us also?
Yes, I think he is. In fact, there's another passage in the New Testament in 2 Corinthians chapters 3 and 4 where this is done by looking at Jesus in the Word and then seeing ourselves in that. Think about hearing and doing idea as it appears in the New Testament so many times. Let me ask Brennan, you get Romans 2 and verse 13. Let's have Tim, you get Matthew 7, verse 21, and then verses 24 through 27. Linda, get Luke chapter 6, and I may need to get exactly verse 46, I believe, is the one that we're looking for here. Luke chapter 6 and verse 46, yes. All right. Randy, if you will, get for us Luke 8, verse 21. And then, Monty, if you'll get for us John 13, verse 17. And there are other passages that we could choose, but observe here how often this thought comes up in the New Testament. This is not a matter just for James, but how often it comes up. Romans 2, verse 13. Brennan?
For not the hearers of the law are just in the sight of God, but the doers of the law will be justified.
All right, and he's talking to his own, Paul's talking to his own people from among his Jewish brethren there, and it's not just the hearer, he says, will be justified, but the one who hears and does. That's a principle throughout the Bible. All right. It's also an idea that Jesus used in his teaching several times. Matthew 7 at verse 21. Tim, you have that? Mm-hmm. All right.
Not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven, but he who does the will of my Father who is in heaven will enter.
Now here we go past just the hearing to the saying, Lord, Lord. Is hearing and saying enough, according to Jesus? No. Hearing, saying, and doing is what he's calling for. Now, listen to this familiar little parable, verses 24 to 27, that same chapter.
Therefore, everyone who hears these words of mine and acts on them may be compared to a wise man who built his house on the rock. And the rain fell, and the floods came, and the winds blew and slammed against the house, and yet it did not fall. For it had been founded on the rock. Everyone who hears these words of mine and does not act on them will be like a foolish man who built his house on the sand. The rain fell, and the floods came, and the winds blew and slammed against the house, and it fell, and great was its fall.
All right, now hearing and doing is likened to building on a foundation that will last. It takes both of those qualities to make it work. All right. The next one, Luke 6, verse 46, wasn't it? Yeah. Okay.
Why do you call me Lord, Lord, and not do what I tell you?
All right. That's similar to what Tim read, but here the idea is, why would somebody call him Lord, Lord, and then not do what he says? What's the answer to that question? The only possible answer. Well, there are two, I suppose. What's the word Lord mean?
Master.
Master or ruler or owner. So if you call him Lord, Lord, and don't do what he says, then what are the possible answers? All right, either you don't know what you're saying or you don't mean what you're saying. Those are the only two possible answers. And if you don't know, the problem is ignorance. And if you don't mean it, what's the problem?
It's lying to yourself and others.
All right, it's self-deceptive, but it's hypocrisy. You don't intend to do what you're saying you're going to do. All right. Then Luke 8, verse 21, Randy.
But he answered and said to them, my mother and my brothers are these who hear the word of God and do it.
All right. The idea of hearing and doing is crucial to God's family, his household. And then John 13, 17.
If you know these things, blessed are you if you do them.
All right, here is the knowing and doing, and had to do with, we'll actually use that passage in our worship time today as well, but the idea of hearing, knowing, saying has to go together with the actual doing of what the Lord's will is in our lives. Now, if you think about this for a moment, why is this point so crucial to the entire message of the book of James? I mean, this book talks about some amazingly wonderful and practical matters, how you deal with temptations and trials, impartiality toward people, not being a respecter of persons. It talks about our words. It talks about our our attitudes toward the world, talks about patience, and so forth. But why is this passage, this point, so crucial to the message of the book?
What difference does any of it make if you're not going to do it?
All right. If this is only a philosophical discussion of what ifs, and that's as far as it's going to go, then what difference does it make? That's exactly James' attitude or James' spirit about this. And why is it that we need this message? We look at this as a very simple matter, but why is it that we need it repeated to us so much? Obviously, it comes up in a lot of contexts in the New Testament. We've read several of them today.
It's much easier for me to see his faults than it is for me to see mine, unless somebody keeps reminding me that I have these.
All right. We can deceive ourselves, he says in verse 22. That's certainly true. I think it's a part of this process, too. There is a natural downward tug that life brings to us here. And this process can happen to us. And you get to a certain place here. And when you reach this place, are you going to start feeling like doing better or being better? You get to a certain place, and what is the only answer to survival? You got to do what you got to do.
That's the difference you have on their indifference. And that if we allow ourselves to become indifferent to life and its correct meaning, then we become indifferent to the concept and to the context of what we're supposed to be doing. And so in that aspect, it represents the difference that we're supposed to have. And so...
Yeah, and so you're not going to get headed in a better direction.
Exactly.
If the difference means nothing to you. That's right.
And in the teaching of history and religion and what we do, this is what keeps us on track.
All right. There has to be something that you hear and then do, even if you don't feel like it. I guess I got to say it that way. And that's the point I think James is making here. All right. Now look at the term he uses in verse 25. The one who looks into the perfect law, the law of liberty, and this version uses the word perseveres. How else is it translated? Endure?
Abides
by it. You make yourself at home in it. Do what?
Continues
in it. What does he mean by that? And why is that so practical?
It's part of you. It's not something you're just in and out of.
All right. Have you guys? That's right. You don't. It's not a one day deal. Have you guys ever seen some sort of an advertisement? My hands are dry right now because of this cold weather. So, what if I see an ad about some sort of lotion or whatever that's going to make my hands moist and so on, and I squeeze one deal and rub it in, and tomorrow I say that stuff. Day after tomorrow, that stuff did no good at all. My hands are dry.
You didn't persevere.
I didn't persevere, right? And you, if you think about what I'm getting at, there are lots of the things that we need to do to overcome and so forth that we'll try one time or one week. You know, I go to church once or twice a month, and then I wonder why it's not helping me. You know, that type of thing. So what he means by it is if you hear what God says, if you'll do it, and if you'll keep doing it, you will discover that it will bless you. Look what he says at the end of it. It's no accident that he's got it worded this way. Whoever looks into the perfect law of liberty and continues or abides or perseveres or endures, not being a hearer who forgets, but a doer who asks, he'll be blessed in his doing. That's the same thing Marty read, Jesus saying in John 13, verse 17, be blessed in his doing. All right. Any other? Okay, Marty, go ahead.
What is his perfect law, the law of liberty? I'm thinking of Moses when he came down from Mount Sinai with the Ten Commandments, told the people, here's statutes and ordinances, I'll guide you into them. Mm-hmm. He'll bring you wisdom and understanding. Mm-hmm. Later on, we see Jesus, he's teaching the people about the Ten Commandments. Not to look upon a woman with lust. Various other things.
He's teaching about the real application of...
I know what Jesus did away with on the cross, I guess, was the ordinances, the law contained in ordinances, the sacrifices. But what is this law of liberty?
Okay, good question. And let me ask you to notice, everybody notice that this phrase that James uses in verse 25 that Monty's talking about comes up also in chapter 2 and verse 12. Everybody see that? It talks there about our being judged under the law of liberty. And it's interesting that this is the concept or this idea, while it may not be worded exactly this way, is one that Paul uses in Galatians to try to emphasize that we're not living under law that God gave through Moses. I mean, look back with me for a second to Galatians 2 and verse 4, Galatians 5 and verse 1, Galatians 5 verse 13, maybe you get the idea here. The law of liberty, what does liberty mean? Well, it means being set free from bondage to something. In Galatians 2 and verse 4, Paul dealt with the problem of some who came in to spy out our what? Our freedom in Christ. And if you consider what he goes ahead to say here, what he's talking about is that some people had come to Antioch where Gentiles had become Christians and had started trying to require them to be circumcised and to keep the law of Moses, the ordinances of the law of Moses, and Paul wouldn't stand for that. In Galatians 5, verse 1, for freedom Christ has set us free. Now stand firm, therefore, and don't submit again to the yoke of bondage. In Galatians 5, verse 13, you were called to freedom, brothers, only do not use your freedom as an opportunity for the flesh, but through love and serve one another. That last phrase is the one that James seems to me to be talking about in James chapter 2. And I think by the law of liberty, he means the gospel with all of its implications and all of its teachings about how we ought to live as people who've been set free from sin. Peter comes to this same idea in 1 Peter 2, verse 16, very similar to Galatians 5, 13. And in both cases, what Paul and Peter both are saying is, you've been set free from sin, you've been set free from condemnation, you've been set free from the ordinances of the law that Monty mentioned there, but you haven't been set free in order to go do the things that the law said not to do in terms of moral living. You've been set free from this. Now go out and live like free people should, honorably, in other words. The short answer, I think the law of liberty refers to the gospel and its teachings about how life ought to be lived. That may not be a good enough answer, but it's the... Okay. Ruth?
Well, I'm still back at Galatians 5, and I'm at 14.
Okay.
The whole law is fulfilled in one word. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. And I'm wondering if this means here, the love. There's not many of those commandments would be dealt ill with if we love.
Well, in Romans 13, it teaches that real love will not do any of the things the law said not to do morally, and it will do will fulfill every right obligation morally. Romans 13. Now, please notice that James uses this phrase, the law of liberty, when he is asking his readers to do what? I've given you the two passages in James where he uses the phrase. What's he asking his readers to do when he uses this phrase? He's asking them to do what they hear. And in chapter 2, we haven't read all of it yet, but he's asking them to treat people mercifully. So I think that might help to answer what he means by it. What he's saying when he uses the phrase law of liberty, to me, is the same thing he's saying when he says he'll be blessed by doing. If he'll hear it and act, he'll be blessed in his doing. That's why it's a law of liberty. This is what raises you to a higher, more noble level of living. I saw, Monty, you had to...
Yeah, this version says, for he who said do not commit adultery also said do not kill. If you do not commit adultery but do kill, you have become a transgressor of the law. So speak, so act as those who are to be judged under the law of liberty.
Yeah, and what he means by the killing here in this passage is somebody who doesn't love his neighbor but shows partiality to the respective person. So I think
somewhat they're still applicable in the sense of guiding us morally.
Absolutely.
Even though the Sabbath is not mentioned.
All right. These things are not here because they're part of the Old Testament law. They are here because they're part of the nature of God, and they're part of what Jesus taught about how life should be lived.
You know, this book was written in the 12 tribes and dispersions, so talking about the Jewish people.
It's talking about Christians who may have been scattered.
Christians are described as 12 tribes.
In this book, we tried to introduce this already. But just tell you the approach we've taken. I tried to show that, at least this is my opinion, Monty. I tried to show that James was regarded as a very respected leader in the church at Jerusalem. That when the persecution that was instigated against when Stephen was killed and that Saul of Tarsus played a large part in, the Christians in Jerusalem up to that point were from a Jewish background. They were scattered from Jerusalem by that persecution. And I have said that since James calls these people my brothers throughout this book, and since he is talking to people who have been begotten again by the word of truth, verse 18 says, been born again by the word of truth, that I think he's talking to Jewish Christians who've been scattered from Jerusalem by the persecution. They would have been familiar with the law, but they understood that they now were ruled by Christ and were under the law of liberty. I saw two other hands. Chatty, one was yours.
In John 12:48, it makes it clear to me what this law of liberty is, that it's Jesus' word, and that's what's going to judge us.
All right, you have one that will judge you. The words that I've spoken will judge you in that day, yes. Okay, and Todd, you had your hand up too.
Well, if I can kind of put into words of perspective too, but then you have the law of the Old Testament, which is a description of how we're supposed to live, and then how, as believers, how we're supposed to act and represent ourselves to those who are not believers in God. But in its consideration, because we are human and because we are imperfect, the only person that could complete the law or that could have enacted justice, if you will, to the law is Jesus Christ.
Okay.
So in that aspect of it that way, well, then Jesus Christ is the perfect or the law of liberty, if you will. Okay. And if you're not believing in that law, if you're not believing in the law of Jesus Christ, and if you're not obeying in that aspect of it, that way of Jesus Christ, and his representation of what his completion to the law represented, because nobody could complete the law.
Okay. Jesus fulfilled it in the sense of doing it. When we call him Lord, we're saying that he is now ruler. Right. And when we do what he says, we will fulfill the moral requirements of the law of Moses.
Which then is the law of Moses.
Right. Now, in this book, please notice that James uses illustrations that his readers could have identified with. When he wants to teach them about hearing and doing, there is a background, like that Brennan read a while ago from Romans 2 and verse 13 to this. That's why he uses the illustration of what he does. The point of James 1, however, is the attitude or the spirit of the people is to be one where They are under pressure. They still regard God as the giver of every good gift and the one who has shown his goodwill already by bringing us to new life by the word of truth. They therefore are humble enough, even under pressure, to be eager to hear what God wants and slow to be angered by the circumstances, and they are people who have an intention to do, to act upon what God says to the best of their ability. Now, before, did both bells get me? Okay, let me just mention this. I'm going to waste my little chart here if I don't. What he does is to take us next to bridling our tongue and visiting the fatherless and the widows. He wants us to see that if we don't become doers, our religion will become weak and ineffective, self-centered. We'll become arrogant, looking down on people, and we'll become merciless in our treatment of other people. We can't let ourselves get self-absorbed and hardened by the problems that we might go through in life. That's what James is getting at here. We'll take a little different approach to it next week. Good questions. Appreciate people being with us today.